Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is your host, Cindy Sheehan. We're back after a couple of months off. I've been working on my documentary and organizing for sizzling summer protests in our nation's capital, and I'll talk more about that later. And I've just been hanging out with my kids and grandbabies. Well, one thing I did do on this hiatus was go to Chicago to speak at an event for a young man who is facing some serious jail time for some bogus charges resulting in an anti-free speech case. At Chicago, I spoke on a panel with former Weather Underground member Bill Ayers, and he is our guest on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today. Bill Ayers was a revolutionary during the Vietnam War, and his group did some damage to a few buildings. Today, he teaches at the University of Chicago at the College of Education and was the subject of some campaign scandal during the 2008 presidential election. Bill, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It's great to have you on. When I was researching the Weather Underground and your part in it, you were one of the founders, I believe, and one of the leaders of the Weather Underground. Is that true?
That's true, in 1970.
Okay, so I was actually in eighth grade. So I'm not saying anything, but of course it was a significant movement. If even an eighth grader in Bellflower, California, heard about it. But one of your organizing principles, I believe, was not acting against violence is violence. And now today, it doesn't seem like much has changed in the 40 years of. This evil, violent empire. We had a situation where many people in 2008 thought that they were voting for change, but it seems like the empire is just as violent or more violent than ever. Can you explain that organizing principle that you all organized around?
We felt very strongly. You know, I was first arrested opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965. I was arrested in a nonviolent direct action sit-in in a draft board in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And at that point, it's hard for people to remember because of the mythology of the 60s, but at that point, there were something like, 80% of Americans supported the war, and only a tiny number opposed the war. But 39 of us were arrested, and interestingly, even in Ann Arbor, Michigan in those days, we were surrounded by people who wanted to see us arrested, kicked out of school, and so on. 3 years later, a majority of Americans opposed the war. There's some familiarity with that number, correct? I mean, 3 years.
Right, exactly.
And suddenly people have turned against it. So what happened in those 3 years? Well, a lot happened. One thing that happened is that people like me made our vocation trying to organize against the war. And we not only got arrested and demonstrated, but we knocked on doors and we tried to talk to strangers to convince them about the horrors of the war. Second thing that happened is the African American freedom movement, the Black freedom movement, and the civil rights movement came out against the war. And King's speeches in the last 3 years of his life are absolutely must reads if you want to understand the state of the world today, because he linked the question of racial justice with the question of economic justice with the question of peace. But most important of all, and this is something you're most familiar with, most important of all, in those 3 years, vets began coming home and telling the truth about what they'd experienced and what they'd been asked to do there. And at that point, the country turned dramatically against the war. The senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry, testified in the Senate when he came back from Vietnam, and he said, "We committed war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy." And that really, really freaked people out. And so by 1968, the country was against the war. The president of the United States announced that he would not run for re-election, but would instead end the war. And we were jubilant at the end of March 1968. But 5 days after that announcement, Martin Luther King was dead. And a couple of months after that, Kennedy was dead. And a couple of months after that, it was clear that the war would not end, but would escalate. And as it escalated, it turned out that 6,000 people a week were being murdered. And we couldn't stop it, even though a majority opposed the war. 6,000 a week were being murdered. And we, those of us in the anti-war movement didn't know what to do. And some of us joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. Some of us ran to Canada or Europe or Africa. Some of us, ran to the communes of the Northeast or the Northwest. And these were all, in my view, legitimate choices. And we decided to build a clandestine movement that could take the war to the war makers. And the reason we did that is because we couldn't figure out how to respond to the murder of 6,000 people. Now, this is a hard case, Cindy, I think, to convince people of. We want to be a peace-loving people. We are sold the notion that we are a peace-loving people. And yet we live in a culture of war and violence. And this is hard to see unless you're really willing to look beneath the surface. People can look out their front door and say, gee, I don't think we're in a war culture. But then you stop and realize that we spend $1 trillion a year on the military. That's more than the rest of the world combined. We're 5% of the world's people spending $1 trillion on military a year.
Right.
We have, we spend more on incarceration than we do on education. So it's kind of a perverse situation that we're living in, and it's something that we have a responsibility, I think, to educate ourselves about.
Well, and then, of course, your target was not people.
Well, that was the other thing that I think 40 years later, the right wing wants to say that we were somehow ultra-violent. The fact is, 6,000 people a week were being killed, and we were remarkably restrained. I mean, it's true that we crossed lines of legality. We might have even crossed some lines of common sense. And I don't defend what we did as brilliant, but I do think that in a situation where your government is killing 6,000 people for nothing, you have a responsibility to speak up and speak out, and we chose, as young people, a very noisy scream against that violence. You know, one of the things also that you mentioned is that 2008, people thought they were voting for peace, and that is true to some degree. But I want to remind all of us that Barack Obama, when he ran for president, and I take his election, incidentally, as significant in a country with the history that we have. It is significant that an African-American was elected. It is a blow against white supremacy. It's not a definitive or a final blow, but it's an interesting and important note. But the more important thing to me is that Obama said continuously during the campaign, I'm a moderate, middle-of-the-road, compromising, pragmatic Democrat. And he might have added ambitious. And the people on the right said, you know, he's lying. He's a palling around with terrorists, and he's a socialist, and he's he's somehow a secret Muslim. And people on the left,
right,
and liberals in particular, said, gee, I think he's winking at me because he's so smart and he's so seemingly so decent. But the truth is he wasn't winking at anybody. He was telling the truth. He's a middle-of-the-road politician. He also said, when asked who King would support, his response was unequivocal. He said King would not support any of us. He'd be in the streets building a movement for justice. So any of your listeners who feel, gee, I wish Obama would bring us peace, should listen to that answer and say to themselves, what have I done today to build a peace movement? What have I done for peace? Not what will Obama do for me, but what am I doing for myself and for the people of the world? I think it's too easy to say the king will make things better for us. All we have to do is elect the right king. The fact is that Lyndon Johnson was never part of the Black Freedom Movement. FDR was never part of the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. Those three presidents are remembered because they did something significant when there was a movement on the ground demanding that they do something significant. That's our job, to create that movement.
Well, and this just like flows great, just wonderfully into my next question. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and you're listening to Cindy Sheehan and my guest, Bill Ayers. But my next question is, we face a crisis, in the late 60s and early 70s, a crisis that never really went away. If it did, if we faced it appropriately, and if we defeated empire permanently, then my son Casey would be alive, and sure, I wouldn't know you, right? And,
that's true.
And, I would still be the proverbial soccer mom in Vacaville, California. But how do you think that we can stop the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? To me, that's the emergency. That's something that has to be stopped, as soon as possible, because June was the worst month in Afghanistan for troops, U.S. troops, but very few people know or care how many Afghan civilians, how many Iraqi civilians have been murdered in these last 9 years. But once we end Iraq and Afghanistan, then we also have to face the fact that we are a militaristic society. So what do you think could be effective steps? Obviously, putting our hopes and dreams in the Democratic Party is not, a way to go. I really think that the people who go in to try to change the party from within actually are the ones that end up being changed. I mean, John Kerry is a perfect example. He said, how can we ask somebody to be the last person to die for a lie? And then he goes and gives George Bush the authority to invade Iraq and Afghanistan and then defend that vote. He defends that vote. Yeah. He did it personally to my face.
Yeah,
so what could be an effective way of confronting the empire? And, obviously we're not going to do it overnight, but what are steps we could take to overthrow this U.S. corporate military empire?
Well, there is no easy answer. You're absolutely right. And there's no formula, and there's no two-step solution that we could adopt. If there were, believe me, I'd adopt it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm eager and anxious and determined mm-hmm. and passionate about this. But I don't think I've become very much an agnostic about social change. But I do know that there's a rhythm to resistance, and there's a rhythm to being in opposition, and there's a rhythm to living the life of a principled, engaged citizen. And I would describe the rhythm simply this way. We have to open our eyes to reality. We have to help others open their eyes, and that means we have to be willing to talk to strangers. We don't have to get into a defensive crouch. We don't have to be whining about, this or that. What we have to do is speak boldly and speak clearly to try to change the frame in which the discussion is taking place. So when people say peacekeepers, we say war makers. When people say, that they come in goodwill and peace, we say occupation and invasion is always wrong, and it always looks very similar. So that when you hear these sad, kind of naive troops saying, gee, we don't know who our friends are or who our enemies are, every invading soldier from every empire in history has had the same problem, because you are an invader, and mm-hmm. that's a sad thing. But the real invaders are at the top. They're the people who run the military and so on. So our job is to open our eyes, for example, to see this lie in Afghanistan, the idea that we now have some huge responsibility to make a new government in Afghanistan. And if you listen to the news reports, our complaint, or the U.S. complaint, is always the same. Gee, these brown people can't seem to run their own affairs. We're doing everything for them, and they can't run their own affairs. But you and I can remember back 9 years ago when this started, and people like us said, this cannot be won. You cannot win it on your own terms. Now they're trying to get the American people ready for the fact that it's going to be a defeat, and they're trying to disguise it as some kind of a staged withdrawal or something. But the fact is that they couldn't win it on their own terms. McChrystal's recent firing is an interesting case in point. Many,
Absolutely.
Many people think that McChrystal, a very smart guy, got himself fired for a very good reason, which is nothing
mm-hmm.
can win. The big debate in the military is, should we use counterinsurgency or should we go no holds barred? Counterinsurgency is the stupidest idea ever, because all it's saying is, gee, if you bomb people's homes and villages into dust, if you destroy their crops and kill their children, they won't like you. No kidding. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
a real brilliant thing that Petraeus and
right.
McChrystal gave us. So they want some restraint, but then the cowboys all say, no, no, you're restraining us. We could win this if you'd let us go. That's what the cowboys said in Vietnam. It was a lie then, and it's a lie now. The Afghans don't want us there. The Iraqis don't want us there. It's time to withdraw. And when? Now. So how do we do that? Well, we have to talk to strangers. We have to go out. And as you, I think, have been a model of displaying your politics in public, you have to stand on a street corner. If that's what it takes in your small town, wherever people are, stand on a street corner every Monday morning, or go down to the federal building and picket, or go to the post office and hold up a sign. The point is, you can't simply say, I'm against the war, and then sit in the comfort of your air-conditioned home and watch it all go down. You have to speak publicly. So we open our eyes, we act, and then we doubt. We wonder, did we do the right thing? Did we do enough? And then we act again. That, it seems to me, is the rhythm of resistance, the rhythm of activism. I have no predictions about how it will turn out, but I intend to live my life as an anti-war activist. I think we all should.
Well, thank you so much for that answer. And that, you know, brings up my next question beautifully. It's almost like we rehearsed this, Bill, but I want to assure my listeners that this is not rehearsed. The reason that I was in near Chicago, was to be on a panel, and we were talking about how speech is being suppressed, and how I think besides, you know, talking to strangers and, you know, just exhibiting the highest moral positions, nobody can fight against you when your position is based on one of nonviolence and of peaceful conflict resolution. However, since Barack Obama has been president, both of us, you and I, have had our speech suppressed. But one thing that neither one of us is willing to do is back down from it or to stop speaking. And I want, you know, I'm here in Washington, D.C. I'm going to start my protests on Sunday, and I have a ban and bar order from the White House. If I go in a certain place, I could go to jail for 6 months, but that's not going to stop me from speaking. And you recently had a situation where neither you nor the students who invited you to speak backed down, and I think that that is another key to resistance, is not backing down, is not to give over our rights to these people. And your case is very interesting because you all were victorious, and I'd like you to tell my listeners about what happened.
Okay, real quickly, I'll tell you about that, and then I want to pick up this question of taking a stand for one more minute. I was invited to speak at the University of Wyoming and then disinvited, and a group of students who had invited me objected and took it into federal court, and I joined the suit. And the reason we did that is because, you know, we felt that to cave in just because somebody says they're going to threaten you or somebody says, you know, you'll hurt our donors' income and so on, that would be, you know, a violation of all of our principles. And as I kept saying during the whole ordeal, the person who's injured in this is not me. I can speak to myself anytime, but a group of students wanted to talk to me. They didn't necessarily say they agreed with me. They wanted to talk to me, just like students want to read a book, and they might want to read several books on the same topic from several points of view. So they have a right, and their free speech is violated when that right is denied. We went into federal court. We had a very conservative judge whose first thing he said to me was, you and I are on opposite sides, because I was a Marine commander in Vietnam. And I said to him, with all due respect, I never felt that I was on the opposite side of the U.S. soldiers. I felt that I was on their side. I wanted them to come home alive and intact. And so I don't see myself as anti-soldier. I see myself as anti-militarism and anti-war. In any case, he ruled that we not only had a right to go to Wyoming to speak, but that security could not trump the First Amendment. And he said, among other things, that if that were the case, there would have been no civil rights movement. So I thought he issued a very brave and good statement from a very conservative judge. The other thing I wanted to say, you're still with me?
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay, good. The other thing I wanted to say in this question of taking a stand, several years ago when the state of Illinois was going to execute John Wayne Gacy, mass murderer, the hoopla around it was so noisy and so excited, and everyone was so thrilled that the state of Illinois was going to reinstate the death penalty, that I felt slightly sickened. And I went down to Statesville to witness and to stand in protest against the death penalty. I had no idea. I did it all by myself. I carried a little sign that said, "Thou shalt not kill." And when I got there, there were thousands of young people having a beer party celebrating the execution of this guy. I made my way to the front of the prison, where I found six nuns and two lawyers, all of us holding candles, and we sang a few civil rights songs, and then Casey was executed, and I made my way home. Well, if I've ever felt marginal in my life, and I have, that was a night of great marginalization, except that 2 years later, one of the lawyers I was standing next to won the first of the wrongful conviction cases in Illinois. That led to several more. That led to a Tribune investigation, and eventually it led to our right-wing, corrupt Governor Ryan putting a hold on the death penalty and bringing everyone off death row. Now, no one could have predicted that night that I went down there and stood
right
with the elderly nuns that we could actually change that. And that's an example where you don't go down and stand in front of the prison because your calculation is you're going to win. You go down because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. And then you figure out how to organize in such a way that you could bring about a tremendous result like that. No one would have predicted that Illinois would lead the nation in opposing the death penalty, but we did.
Oh, that's just a perfect example of how what I want to finish my this interview with. We just have a few minutes left, and this is going to air for the first time on the 4th of July. Many people would argue that our country was founded on violence. It's a country. I mean, we can't even argue this. It's fact. We had slavery, the almost near extermination of the native population, so it's founded on genocide. We support many, genocides around the world and dictatorships, and very seldom is our country. And by country, I mean our leadership on the side of morality. Having said that, many of our fellow Americans, people who live in this country, I think, of course, they're propagandized and so misinformed or just trying to survive in this world, and it would take a lot of people a lot of sacrifices to be able to go and stand in front of a federal prison to do that. They'd have to leave a job, or they'd have to find a babysitter, or they'd have to know about it in the first place. And and that's that's definitely a big obstacle to our changing anything in this country, is we are so propagandized and so led away from facts. It's pitiful.
Right.
But today we find out, or not find out, it's not big news, that the CEO of Walmart makes more in 1 hour than the people that work for Walmart. He makes more than they make in 1 year.
Right.
In 1 hour.
Right.
So we have just a lot of struggle and a lot of oppression in our own country, and a lot of people just trying to survive. But something in your biography that I read said that you were really inspired by this quote from then president of the Students for a Democratic Society, Paul Potter. He said, "How will you live your life so it doesn't make a mockery of your values?"
Exactly.
Well, you can barely be an American without having your personal values mocked every day. So how can we, as just regular people, not very many people know that before I went to Crawford, Texas, I was just like the most average American on the face of the earth, and I just saw a need, and I filled it. So how can just average Americans, besides doing what you've already mentioned, just stand up for our human values, not the values of this society?
Well, exactly. It seems to me that that is the challenge, and that you said it very well. I'm always reminded that Martin Luther King said again and again, we are, as a country, on the wrong side of the world revolution, and we need a revolution in values if we're going to have a revolution in fact. And by that he meant we need to rethink and re-examine where we are on the clock of the universe, where we are in this country, and we need to wake ourselves up. You know, what it means to me to be a moral person, an ethical person, is surely to look at the world as it is. But then, and this is the critical step, you have to be able to imagine or build or construct or notice that another world is possible. And it's that other world that we should be striving toward, a world that's more just, more at peace, with relatively more democracy and more egalitarianism. That, it seems to me, is something that we can't describe perfection, but what we can do is every day press to make sure that we're working toward a world that's fit for human beings. And I take the spirit of Martin Luther King, the spirit of Jane Addams, the spirit of Cindy Sheehan to be something that keeps me going when I have my doubts, and everybody has doubts all the time. So I want to thank you and think that we have to just keep pushing on, not because we're going to win, but because it's the way we choose to live.
And like you said, you never know what little act is going to be the tipping point.
Exactly.
And, you know, in 2005, when I sat down in a ditch in Crawford, Texas, it might not have ended the empire, but there was a lot of good things that came out of it. A lot of people got activated and organized that never were before. And, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to see the mountaintop, but we have to keep climbing that hill or that mountain, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. And I came down to Crawford, Texas, right after you did that, because I wanted to meet you, which I did. And I was so shocked to be in an encampment, a peace encampment, that was run so in such a disciplined way. And I said, damn, these military families know how to run a peace camp. It wasn't a bunch of hippies. We had lunch right on time. I was on garbage detail. I kept the place clean. So it was a lovely, lovely gesture that you made there. Very
well. We'll have to give all the credit to Anne Wright for that, retired colonel. And she was a U.S. diplomat that actually had to, many times in emergencies, pack up whole embassies to get them going. So Anne Wright was the one that kept the meals on time at Camp Casey. No, I didn't have anything to do with that.
Fabulous. Well, I'm used to a peace encampment that has no discipline at all. So I was pretty impressed. Anyway,
well,
it's a pleasure
it was a
to
great
talk to you.
Time. Okay, Bill, and thank you, and I hope you have a happy 4th.
I hope you do, too.
Whatever you do with your family.
Well, I'm going to see my grandchildren, and remember, it's Independence Day, so we all have to do something independent, and I plan to be a rebel all day on the 4th and every day after. I hope to see
and
you.
And we're in front of the White House declaring our independence from petroleum and hoping
go.
To build a better world that way. Well, thank you, Bill Ayers, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks. Keep at it, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Today, when the show airs for the first time, it will be the USA's 234th birthday. Many people will be celebrating around the country while we have several disasters happening and brewing. My organization, Peace of the Action, P-E-A-C-E of the Action, that's at peaceoftheaction.org, will be in Lafayette Park in front of the White House, demanding that we as a people and we as a nation reduce our dependence on petroleum. Go to www.peaceoftheaction.org for more info or to see how you can help. And that's just the start of our actions for July. So we're having 2 weeks of actions. You can see where you can plug in. You can see where you can help, or you can donate if you can't make it to Washington, D.C. Well, I'm glad Cindy Sheehan Soapbox is back on the air with new shows, and we'll be talking to you next week. But as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott, my webmaster, Rich, my producer, Mikey, and you most of all for listening. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and I'm Cindy Sheehan.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.